Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. President Obama returned to Washington Sunday night. At the top of his agenda, an address tomorrow night before a joint session of Congress aimed at generating new enthusiasm for a health care overhaul. The question of a public option remains central to the debate. Joining me to discuss challenges he faces and what's ahead for Congress, Jonathan Weissman, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent of Time Magazine, and John Dickerson, chief political correspondent for Slate.com and CBS political analyst and contributor. Welcome to you all. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You can join us, as always. Please do. 1-800-433-8850 is our number. drshow@wamu.org, our email address. Jonathan, you were with the president yesterday, Labor Day speech in Cincinnati. A distinctly different tone than what we've been hearing over the last weeks and months from the president.
Yeah, you know, this summer, President Obama kind of had this school marmishness. He would do these town hall meetings. The first 15 minutes would be a kind of a quasi-speech, but half of it would be about the stimulus and the economy. And then he would go into healthcare, and then he would answer questions. It were actually kind of boring. You know, for all the attention to raucous town hall meetings, President Obama's were not exactly. Yesterday was a completely different tone. It was really was a campaign event. This was an AFL-CIO picnic. He obviously had a very friendly crowd. And, you know, he did things that he has not done since Election Day. He led the chair, fired up, ready to go. He told old war stories from the campaign. He really got things rolling. I talked to Richard Trumka after the speech, the Secretary Treasurer of the AFL-CIO, and he said, I wish President Obama had given that speech a month ago or 2 months ago.
But, Karen, did you see anything different in terms of substance? Tone, maybe, but what about substance?
You know, I think that is really supposedly going to come tomorrow. The White House is promising that the president, when he goes in front of that joint session of Congress, is going to be a lot more specific than he has been in the past. You know, interestingly enough, there were people in the White House who didn't want to do this speech this week. They wanted to put it off until next week, get past the 9/11 anniversary, get past the anniversary of Lehman's collapse. And I'm told, at least, that it was President Obama himself who came back from vacation and realized that he needed some kind of circuit breaker here. And so, you know, it was his idea, at least I've been told, to do something to sort of put this debate back on track.
And over the weekend, John Dickerson, that there was talk about, from his spokesman, Robert Gibbs, about drawing lines in the sand, but on the other hand, not issuing veto threats. Do you have a sense of what might be in this speech?
Well, it's funny you mentioned talking about drawing lines in the sand. You know, there was a time when they said we're going to get more specific. One of the things I get a sense of is the president's going to say a lot of things he said before, but in this new environment. Karen did a great interview with the president back in July in which he argued with her that he'd been quite specific about a variety of things, and now they're saying we're going to get more specific. They are going to get more specific about what he wants. The big question, of course, will be the public option. One of the slight disconnects yesterday was he had this campaign style and rhetoric and was whipping up the crowd. And then when he talked about the public option, he said, I continue to believe that a public option within the basket of insurance choices would help improve quality and bring down costs. That's not exactly, you know, rousing campaign rhetoric. I will fight for this to the last dog dies.
And his people have been saying pretty clearly, while he still prefers it, still wants it, they are not making this a be-all or end-all.
They're talking a lot about competition and choice, you can feel it. They are creating an allowing room for an ultimate deal in which they say, look, we've gotten to our goal, which was not necessarily public option, but competition and choice. So I think there's going to be – that's the key thing I'm looking for, of course, on Wednesday night.
Now, Jonathan, talk also about whether – we're seeing a different strategy. The president, known very much as a consensus builder and very much aware that Bill and Hillary Clinton tried to proscribe a bill for Congress and failed,
yep.
And therefore has been letting the congressional committees take the lead. But there's been increasing uneasiness with that strategy as the committees have failed to really come up with a final package. Do you see more leadership out of the White House? Will there be a different approach to this legislative strategy going forward?
Yeah, one thing that Obama said yesterday was, you know, we've had a healthy debate, it was fine, but there's always a time where the debate has to end and it's time to act. And the White House is going to act. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they will produce a bill the way the Clintons did, but they're going to go up to Capitol Hill and start really leading where the fine details are going to go. And they're basically, the Democrats in Congress are begging them to. I remember Javier Becerra, a congressman from California, told me, he said, ultimately, you know, he's the shepherd and we're the sheep, and if he doesn't lead us, we're heading to the wolves.
I've never heard a congressman describe himself as a sheep and
he's
mean
from
it.
A safe district. Yeah.
But you know, though, if there's a template for this, you might look back at the way they handled the stimulus bill, where they let Congress write its bill. But then when you get down to needing those last couple of votes in the Senate, that's when Rahm Emanuel goes up and parks himself in Harry Reid's office and sits down with Olympia Snow and Susan Collins and Ben Nelson, and he starts the deal.
And Karen, what about from the congressional side? You and I spent many years together covering Congress, and when members come back this week, it's always an important moment. What's the sense of how the landscape is different today than when they left town a month ago? What did they hear back home, and how does that factor into the political climate?
Well, you know, there was the nutty stuff. There were the death panels and some of the kind of goofy rumors that were out there. My sense in talking to members is that isn't what unsettled them as much as a much kind of deeper unease among their constituents. One is that they just feel like after everything else that's come out of Washington this year, you know, the stimulus package, the bailout of GM, this is just too much to take on. And the second deeper unease is among people who have health insurance and are relatively satisfied with it, which is they look out there at the things that the government is trying to do with the health care system, and they see a lot of other people getting helped, but they're worried my own health care is going to suffer.
You know, John, this has been reflected in polling numbers, where the president's own approval rating down about 10 points, still pretty healthy, but approval for his handling of health care has now dipped under 50%. What's your take on why those numbers are dropping?
Well, there are a number of reasons that those numbers are dropping. I mean, everything from the fact that people watch the congressional process dribble out over many months, and that's what they saw rather than hearing the president. So they're confused in these polls. More than 60% of the people say they have no idea what the president's in the president's plan or the congressional plans. But a lot of these numbers were going south before we got into the crazy period of August. And what was appearing in the polls was that they agreed with the president's diagnosis. People wanted to change the system, but they did not agree with his cure. They didn't agree with the proposals he was putting forward. And I talked to somebody in the leadership in the House, an aide, who said, you know, the big problem is we went out and said, here, we're going to do these great things, and people agreed with what we wanted to do. They just didn't think we could carry it through. They didn't trust us to be able to enact any of this.
Well, let's try to break down some of these points, because let's start with the point that Karen made. You say people support change in general, but if you ask people, you got 160 million Americans who have health insurance, and you ask them if they are happy, more than 80% generally are happy.
Right.
So part of what's happening is, it would seem, that this man who was elected as a change agent when it comes to health care, actually a lot of the people who voted for him are resistant to change and afraid of change.
Well, that's right. It's been true for some time that the closer the health care decision, the change gets to you, the more frightened people are. So they liked it in the abstract, but then when they started to think about how it would affect them in their own plans, they were resistant. If you look at the polling numbers now, there is a gap between the number of people will say, yes, I want change, and then if you ask them, well, do you think it'll affect you? A lot of people say no, or it'll affect me for the worse.
For the worse.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because the Democrats and the supporters of these health care changes knew this was coming. In 2005, there was this group put together called – they called themselves the Herndon Alliance because they met in Herndon, Virginia. But it was like the American Cancer Society, this – you know, some liberal health care groups like Families USA and also SEIU, the big union. They went out in 2005, 2006 and started doing polling – focus groups, started slicing the American electorate very thinly. And what they heard over and over was what the sociologists call loss aversion, that somebody else's gain is going to be my loss, that if you're going to give 56 million Americans without health insurance, my costs are going to go up, and or I'm going to have less care.
And the other factor, Karen, that Obama could not have anticipated a year ago or 2 years ago on the campaign when he was promising change was the economic situation and the need to spend almost $800 billion on a stimulus package, $700 billion. And Newt Gingrich, the former Speaker of the House, said on TV over the weekend, Americans care about two things. They care about jobs and they care about the deficit. And these were two elements out of Obama's control, and it makes the climate that much more difficult to convince people that this is the right thing to do now.
And the president is very much aware of that, and he also addressed that in that interview that I did with him in July, and he said, look, you know, there was all this stuff I had to do first. And he said, I still think this is the right thing to do on top of it. But, you know, if I hadn't had to do the stimulus and the car companies and everything else, I'd have had health care done by now.
Well, it was not. And the other point you made earlier that I think is so significant is this underlying suspiciousness that a lot of Americans have that government can do this well.
And you know, and I was going to say, and Karen's absolutely right. People feel they don't know exactly what's going on, but they just feel like waves and waves coming at them from Washington. Nothing they've seen before, and they just feel overwhelmed by it. They don't believe this stuff. You go to some of these town hall meetings, and people are saying, "You just did cash for clunkers. How can you do health care?"
That's Jonathan Weissman from the Wall Street Journal, Karen Tumulty from Time Magazine, John Dickerson from Slate. I'm Steve Roberts sitting in for Diane. We'll be back with your calls and your questions. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts sitting in today for Diane, and our subject this hour is health care, with Congress back in town, President back in town, and the President's scheduling of a major address to the joint session of Congress tomorrow night. Jonathan Weissman, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, is with me. Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine, John Dickerson of Slate. John, in addition to these questions we've been talking about of people reluctant to change and reluctant to trust the government to do the change well, and the overwhelming waves of government spending and that have come with the stimulus package and these bailouts, there's also the political climate. Start talking about the Democrats. One of the problems that Obama has is that as a majority, that means there are a lot of Democrats on the left who say, it's got to be a liberal bill, and conservatives say, I won't vote for a liberal bill, particularly with a public option. So he's, in some ways, the biggest splitter within his own party.
That's right. And yesterday in his speech, he was talking about the opponents to reform, but he didn't get specific because he could have been talking about Republicans or Democrats. You've got, as you say, in his problem with the Democrats is twofold. One, it's a question of cost. Democrats who are worried about the price tag on this and getting nailed with hooking into this larger feeling and worry about government spending.
And these are particularly some of the newer members been elected in the last two elections from kind of moderate suburban districts who were, feel very vulnerable to the old tax and spend argument.
Precisely, exactly. And that's also what's causing him trouble with senators who are worried about cost, but also the government portion of this and whether there will be a public plan. So those are two. And then he's got almost universal Republican opposition, with the exception of perhaps Olympia Snowe and maybe her colleague from Maine, Susan Collins, who are sort of the last two hopes for being able to have some kind of a bipartisan deal in the Senate.
Isn't this also a very significant part of the underlying political picture here? Because Obama came in, he campaigned on a whole approach to government of ending partisanship and ending bickering. But when he's gotten here, he's discovered that a lot of the moderate Republicans have been defeated by Democrats, which is one of the reasons why they're in the majority. And there are very few people to negotiate with.
Sure. As Rahm Emanuel has said for a long time, there's no John Chafee. It was the Republican from Rhode Island.
And no John Danforth, and no Warren Rudman, and no Bill Cohn. I mean, there's a long list of them.
Exactly.
No Arlen Specter.
Chafee was in the 93 reform. There's nobody like that now. You know, one other thing just about Obama, he was trying to provide some cover for these conservative Democrats by talking a lot about the deficit, explaining how his reform would, and his budget director talked about this a great deal, how his reform would deal with that long-term budget picture. And now that's one of the things that people are criticizing the president for. He talked too much about the deficit and not enough about how it would help people. Of course, when he talks about how reform will help people, say yes, but isn't it going to cost a lot and cause a trouble with the deficit? So that's part of the box that he's in.
And let's talk about some of these specifics, Jonathan. A lot of attention is focused on this public option. Yesterday, when he spoke to these union people, there was strong support for a public option among the unions. Basically, quickly describe what that public option really is and why it's become the benchmark for both the opponents and the supporters.
Well, you know, the core of the bill is that everybody would have to go out and buy insurance, you know, just like you have to go buy your car insurance. But to do that, there would be a federal exchange. So there'd be one-stop shopping, a place to go buy your insurance policy. And on that exchange, some people, the left, want a government-run insurance policy, kind of like Medicare. You could buy this. It would be trying to buy a government plan, and then it would be alleged ostensibly cheaper. It would be not for profit. It would cover everything that Medicare covers, and it would be the competition with the private plans on that exchange that would supposedly hold the prices down. Now, the big flashpoint is that Republicans and some Democrats fear that if you have a government option out there, that there's no way that the private insurers can compete with it because they're obviously trying to turn a profit, or even nonprofits have to, you know, pay their workers, and that ultimately people will just slowly or even quickly move to this public plan. It will become kind of a de facto Medicare for all.
Now, we have an email on this very subject. Let me read it to you from Craig in Cincinnati, Ohio. Your panel is not telling the entire truth. Poll after poll consistently shows 72-76% of Americans continue to support a public option. Please tell the entire story. You think that's fair?
Well, it all depends on how the polling is asked. I mean, if you, it's funny because, you know, the Democrats also did a lot of polling. The reason that we talk about public option is because they went and tried to see if government run would fly or Medicare for all would fly. They wouldn't. So we're now talking about a public option. It sounds nice.
And Karen, when you talk about the politics here, you have liberal Democrats in the House, 60 or 70 of them, signing a letter saying, we will not vote for any bill that doesn't have a public option. And then in the Senate, you have Senator Kent Conrad leading Democrats saying, there are not the votes for a public option in the Senate. So you really have a very basic division.
And it's because the underlying political tension here is that the public option was put in the Obama plan during the campaign. It was also in Hillary Clinton and John Edwards' plans, basically as a sop to single-payer advocates on the left, people who would really like to see a sort of European-style, Canadian-style government-financed healthcare system in this country. So it was put in there as something to win them over. And a lot of them, quite frankly, think the public option is the, you know, to use the cliche, the camel's nose under the tent to a single-payer system. And by the way, that's the same reason that a lot of conservatives are fighting it so hard. But I think that it is actually a sort of sideshow from what the bill is, the basic fundamentals of the bill and what's it trying to do, which is more along the lines of what Jonathan was talking about, which is setting up a more efficient marketplace where people would be required to have insurance and they could have a lot more and more transparent options when they purchase it. And some help, by the way, in buying it.
And John, you were talking actually off the air that people don't focus on the fact that there actually is a wide agreement on a number of these insurance reforms, including among some Republicans.
That's right. And this is one of the reasons the White House and advocates for the president's plan don't want to talk about public option, because it gets us down into a narrow little tiny alley and away from what the goodies that are on the bill. I mean, the notion that you can have insurance, not have it taken away from you, not have coverage denied. One of the interesting things I'm looking for in Wednesday's speech is a number of the president's allies want him to turn the insurance companies into even greater villains than he has so far. He did a little bit of this in the speech yesterday, talking about the insurance companies raking in profits and how they have to play fair. The idea is that the only way you can really get people to focus on the reforms that are going to be good for them in this package is to say, hey, look, these insurance companies are really the dark villains in this narrative. This reform proposal will protect you.
Well, isn't that also partly goes right back to something you were talking about earlier, which is if so many people already have insurance and are generally happy with it, that in order to get them to accept change, you really have to frighten them a little bit. You have to raise the anxiety level that, well, you might be happy now, but your premiums could go up, or you could lose insurance if you get sick, and try to get people to look at what's in their interest, even though they seem to be happy.
Right. And that's, in fact, something the Obama people thought in a lot of ways was actually something everybody understood. From the minute he started selling this proposal, he talked about how even people who have insurance were one illness away from bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. And he used this sort of outdated and a little hyperbolic figure about the number of bankruptcies caused by health insurance to play on that very notion that even if you think things are okay, you're really more on the edge than you think. And because of the ballooning cost of health care and the health care inflation, ever more will those of us with insurance be in this perilous position.
Jonathan, give me a sense of how you think this is going to play out. Over the weekend, Senator Alexander from an important player, Lamar Alexander from Tennessee, what's left of the marginally moderate wing of the Republican Party in the Senate, said, look, the best thing for the president to do is break this down into a series of smaller bills, get a small victory this year on the issues, as John was saying, that there is a fairly wide consensus in terms of insurance reform, as opposed to trying to do too much, a 1,000-page bill being too much for Congress to swallow. How do you see this playing out?
Well, the problem with Lamar Alexander's prescription is that there's everything relies on everything else. For instance, the insurance companies have said, we're willing to go along with ending pre-existing conditions. We're willing to stop doing this thing called rescissions, where somebody gets sick, you go through and find some pretext to drop your insurance plan. We're willing to stop capping lifetime benefits at, you know, $1 million or something. But in order to do that, you have to give us access to 46 million new customers. In order to give access to 46 million new customers, the U.S. federal government has to give help to some of these people who can't afford to go out and buy insurance, some subsidies to go out and buy. You can't cut one piece off and pass that separately. For instance, you decide to pass a bill on insurance reform, just on things like ending pre-existing conditions, then the insurance companies will go ballistic because they're saying, well, we didn't get what we needed, which was the added customer base. A lot of those customers, by the way, are young and healthy, and they're going to help the bottom line for the insurance companies.
And can I just say, too, that what really got this, I think, whole debate going is health care costs. The fact that even if you have health insurance and if you're an employer who really wants to insure your workers, the costs have been going up so fast that they have just been crippling individuals and businesses. And if you really want to get a handle on costs, everybody's got to be in the system. You cannot have uninsured people continuing to show up in hospital emergency rooms by the droves. And that's one of the reasons that this bill is so expensive. And I think...
But also one of the reasons why the bill is hard to sell, because to get people to understand the larger macro economic costs of not controlling the system is very hard when people look, as we've been saying, at their own policies and say, well, I'm reasonably happy with what I have.
Well, I think the single most important thing to watch going forward is not the debate over the public option or some of these other flashpoints, mm-hmm. but how much help the government is going to give people who are on the edge of they're being required to buy insurance, but they can't quite afford it.
Karen's right. That is when people talk about the cost of the bill, the cost is the size of the subsidy. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's driven, and you can dial it up or dial it down. So, for instance, Susan Collins, the fate of this bill basically hangs on Susan Collins from Maine and Olympia Snowe from Maine, because the Democrats know, look, if they can get Ted Kennedy's seat filled, they need one Democrat, I mean, one Republican, two Republicans, they'll be okay. They just need to get these people. And Susan Collins, her biggest problem is the size of the cost. You can dial that down, just lower the subsidy.
But you leave people out if you do.
I'm glad you mentioned Ted Kennedy, because his death over the summer was one of the important developments here, John Dickerson. And it's not just that the Democrats don't have his vote. They eventually will, presumably, if they win the Senate seat. But his leadership and his ability to sell a compromise to the liberals down the line is really the loss.
It is a loss. And you also get the sense that selling even Republicans, too. I mean, yes, for sure, with liberals, because they would know if he took a deal, it meant that was the best deal that was on the table.
He would be credible.
But also, you know, there were those Republicans he'd had these relationships right. with that he'd built up over the years. And we'll see. There's now some movement in the Finance Committee, hurried along in part by the president's decision to speak on Wednesday night. And maybe now there will be an inkling, but it doesn't look like there's a lot of bipartisanship coming out of the Finance Committee.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let me read you some emails here. Bob writes to us, all the news reports seem to be about the Senate Finance Committee, but haven't other committees in the Senate and House also generated health care reform bills? What's in those bills, John?
Well, those are bills. The reason the Finance Committee gets a lot of attention is, A, they're still doing their work, and we love following the process. And also, there are nominally a few Republicans still hanging on to that in the Health, Education, Labor Committee and Pensions Committee. And the Senate has produced, not a bill, but they've gotten something out of committee. That didn't have Republican support. And then there are bills that in the House that also passed without Republican support. So those bills tend to be more liberal than what we are hearing out of the Finance Committee, which is why and the Finance Committee, we may even start getting more details as soon as today.
And we should explain the process, Karen, that once these committee bills are all done, then there has to be a process in each House of putting them together to get a common bill that comes to the floor.
Yeah, you know, and where I think this bill ultimately is going to get written is in Harry Reid's and Nancy Pelosi's offices.
Down the line.
If they can get a bill out of the Senate.
Right.
Let me read this email from Michael, and he writes to us through Facebook, and we encourage our listeners to use Facebook as one of many ways to contact the Diane Rehm Show. And Michael writes, when so many Americans believe so many myths about the health care reform, it is cause for concern about the ability of Americans to think. We used to have discussions. Now it seems that all we have is people screaming lies at each other. Talk about this dimension, Jonathan, the myths of the death panels and others that have received such currency among critics, and even when there's not much evidence that they're true.
I got an email from a woman telling me to look at this one, a certain page of the House bill, and explaining that it explains that you have to have a card, and if the card doesn't have the coding right, you're sent to a end-of-life counselor. I took her up on it, and I looked at it. It was this boring section on what private insurers needed to put on the card they gave people to say what their policies covered. So, you know, your doctor or your nurse didn't spend all their time calling the insurance company and asking what the policy covered. It's amazing. But, look, my opinion is that the people who believe in death panels and those things, They never supported this bill. The problem is that this great mass in the middle that really don't understand what's going on, they hear all this screaming and yelling, they see the president having problems with a Democratic Congress, and they just think, huh, something must be wrong. And that's the damage that's been done.
Before we go to our callers, Karen, talk about the stakes for the president tomorrow night. Peter Bacon, the New York Times, called it a make-or-break moment. And this is not just about health care. It's about his ability to put through a lot of other items on his agenda.
Well, I think we in Washington tend to overblow the significance of individual speeches. How many make or break speeches have we heard in the last 2 weeks?
Fair enough.
But I do think healthcare is a make or break issue, because I think there's an argument being made, and I think it's a valid one, that if this Congress run by Democrats and this president who is a Democrat can't get anything done, the consequences could be very much like what Bill Clinton saw in 93 and 94. And maybe he doesn't lose the Congress the next year, but they are going to lose a lot more seats if they can't get anything done.
And does this argue then for a presidential strategy, which is sign almost anything and call it victory?
Well, sort of yes and no, because if you sign something that is too politically unpopular or something that is not sustainable over the next couple of years as it's being implemented, that's a different kind of political disaster.
That's Karen Tamelty of Time Magazine. John Dickerson of Slate is with me. Jonathan Weissman of The Wall Street Journal. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. We're going to go right to your phone calls as soon as we come back, so stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe on the web at germany.info, and by Global Nutritional Research, maker of Clotamin, a multivitamin designed for people on blood thinners, at clotamin.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Sisters can be the best of friends or the fiercest of rivals. Linguist Deborah Tannen explores how family dynamics and a parent who plays favorites can influence a lifetime of communication among sisters. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. Our subject this hour, healthcare and the president's address to Congress tomorrow night and what we can expect. Jonathan Weissman is with me from The Wall Street Journal, Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine, John Dickerson of Slate. And we'll go to our callers. And Lynn in Dayton, Ohio, thanks for waiting. You're on The Diane Rehm Show. Lynn? Okay, I guess Lynn's not there. Let's go to Bernadette in Laconia, New Hampshire. Bernadette?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a comment. My mind is swirling with all that I'm hearing from the extreme right. When President Obama was elected, okay, he promised to do certain things for the country, health care and reducing the debt and a whole bunch of other stuff that he was handed by the Republican administration that was in office for 8 years. President Bush and Cheney did not take up issues with the debt. They put us into a war that was not wanted and is running up a debt. And when I hear people yelling about insurance and medical coverage and all the other stuff that Obama's trying to do, I just shake my head sadly and say, where were you for the 8 years that Bush Cheney were in office?
Okay, Bernadette.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much for your call. John Dickerson.
Well, that's a probably a valid point. Unfortunately, as far as the president goes, it only gets you so far. I mean, that doesn't help him convince people to get behind this program. But again, I go back to this box that he's been in. I mean, he recognized early on this sensitivity to the deficit number. It's been one of his problems before we got into this healthcare situation in convincing people that his programs will not blow the deficit, and now people worry about that in particular with his healthcare reform. So the caller has a valid argument, but it's as far as this debate goes, it only takes you so far.
And you know, Americans are skeptical about government, and one of the reasons that Barack Obama was elected was because of skepticism about government. Mm-hmm. It just happened to be a Republican government. They're still skeptical about government, which is just a Democratic government.
And another caller writes to us. People will begin – Colin wants to know when people will begin to think of others. They're always worrying about themselves in terms of health care. Karen, this is part of what we've been talking about, that the world looks different whether you focus on the macro picture or your own personal situation.
Right. I think if the president has to wait for that, he's not going to get a bill this year, which is why he keeps trying to emphasize to people that this has benefits for you. It can ultimately help bring down health care costs that are killing the economy, and it can ultimately give you a lot more security that you know you're going to keep your health coverage no matter what else goes on in your life.
Let's turn to Michael in Conway, Arkansas. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, Michael.
Oh, thank you so much for taking my call. It seems to me that President Obama has two rather large hurdles now. One is to convince those with insurance that the status quo cannot be sustained, as Ms. Tumulty has said, and you know this, of course, threatens their health care. But then also he's got to convince the liberals that the cost curve can be bent through regulation without the need for a public option. I'm wondering why, and what I'm thinking of is the Dutch plan, which is, as I understand it, is kind of like the Massachusetts plan, except that people have more of a choice within the buying pools, and the R word, which I never hear in these discussions, regulation. They regulate the cost of rates and that kind of thing. Why is this not talked about?
John Dickerson.
Well, the Dutch plan has been talked about on the margins by various people. It's the in terms of the conversation now. I'm not sure why it's not talked about, except for that politically we're at the point at the stage where public option looks like it's dying. So it would be.
The caller comes from Arkansas. This is a good example. This is a state with two very moderate, at best, Democratic senators who are among the group who are very reluctant to talk about exactly this sort of thing.
But Michael is right. When I've talked to both healthcare economists and the sort of wonky people on the Hill and at the White House, they say that getting these exchanges set up right, where there is genuine competition and that it is enforced by, you know, regulation that doesn't let insurance companies kind of slide out through the cracks, is more important than any other aspect of the government side of this.
Well, can I say something about the R word here? I mean, the president talks about regulation all the time.
All the time.
He just doesn't call it regulation. When you talk about ending the use of pre-existing conditions or lifetime caps, that's a regulation that he would impose. The one R word he never uses is rationing. And rationing is where you really save money.
Let me ask you briefly to talk about, two other proposals that are on the table. We talked about the public option, which, as you say, support is fading. But one option has been raised by Senator Conrad of North Dakota, which are these cooperatives, which would be nonprofits as opposed to a public-run system, but nonprofits based on a lot of co-ops that exist largely in rural America. And then there's the question of the trigger where you would not have a public option immediately, but it would be implemented if certain goals were not met. These are two options on the table.
That's right. The co-op in the narrative of this is, again, where we find ourselves talking about the Finance Committee again, which is this is where these ideas have come to life. These are all workarounds to get support for a public option-like animal without calling it a public option. The problem is that co-ops don't get you that much. It gets you, Conrad, a couple of conservative Democratic senators, maybe, but it doesn't get you the public option. It doesn't fool any of the public option supporters. And that went away. The trigger has been an idea Olympia Snow has supported. The White House floated their openness to it, again, talking about competition and choice. If they frame this in terms of competition and choice, then they argue they can accept a trigger, they can accept a co-op, or they can accept a public plan. The trigger has come back into vogue. Its two elements would be, one, it would kick in after 3 to 5 years if private insurance companies weren't acting competitively in these exchanges, or if there were certain geographical locations like Maine where you had where there wasn't real choice for people.
And by the way, that would be a big improvement on the current system. What a lot of people don't realize is in most places of this country, if you have to go out and buy a health insurance policy, you're not going to get from your employer, you're buying into a monopoly. On almost every state, the entire market is controlled by one or two big players. So you don't have a lot of choice.
Let me turn to Les in Dallas, Texas. Welcome. You're on the Diane Dream Show, Les.
Yes. When we watch people like Congressman Conyers come on and say they're not going to read a 1,000-page bill, they need days and two lawyers to explain it to them. We watch the town hall meetings and senators say there is no bill, or if that were in the bill, I wouldn't support it, but I don't know what's in the bill. Nobody seems to have any real understanding of what's in the 1,000 pages. The whole discussion is revolved around death panels when there's 1,000 pages. Senate Finance Committee has tax increases in the bill nobody knows about. There's details that aren't being discussed. We don't trust them to vote on a 1,000-page bill that they don't understand.
Thank you, Les, very much. This word trust, very important word in this debate, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think that trust, Les hit it. People don't trust what Congress is going to do. I mean, I've read large chunks of this 1,000-page bill. It is mind-numbingly dull reading. So, it's not that surprising that people don't know everything that's in it. The fact is, the Democrats have really been hurt by the fact that they don't have a bill. There is a huge piece of work that has come out of three committees in the House, but ultimately that's not what's going to go to the floor of the House because it's going to have to go through a whole bunch of revisions. The Senate, there's something that came out of one committee, but it's not what's going to be voted on. So, these lawmakers have gone to these town hall meetings. People have said, well, what about this in the bill? It's very hard to say, well, that's not necessarily what's going to be in the bill.
And, Karen, this goes to another dimension we haven't talked about, which I know you've written a lot about, which is what role could or might be played by the vast army of Obama supporters, 13 million people who signed up for the campaign. The theory was that they could be called upon to help support the president's legislative agenda at key points, but it sputtered in part because, as Jonathan said, there isn't a bill, there isn't a specific vote, there isn't a specific date. So that army has not really taken the field very well.
And it's also divisions within the army. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of people who supported the president would prefer to see a single-payer system. And as they were trying to gear up the grassroots, what's left of the campaign operation was having a real problem because they were sort of trying to silence the single payer advocates in their midst. And I think this public option debate also, it demoralizes a lot of their supporters.
That's exactly right. When you talk about the villainous insurance companies, which the president started to do increasingly at the end of July heading into the August recess, it was in part to gin up and get excited these supporters. The problem is when you get those supporters enraged about the villainy of the insurance companies, the best way to knock the insurance companies over the head is with a public option.
But in defense of the Obama army, I mean, one of the reasons I think that the town hall meetings got a little less coverage toward the end is because they became exercises in turning out your base. So you would have these huge groups of Obama supporters on one side and then the groups from the Tea Parties on the other, and they would just scream at each other, and it devolved into silliness. So they kind of countered each other.
Let's turn to Marianne in Reston, Virginia. Marianne, welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi. One issue I have not really heard much talked about is the difference between the retail price that non-insured people pay for services as opposed to the wholesale price that's paid by the insurance companies. Just by way of an example, I had some major surgery this past winter, just taking one bill, which was about $8,000. Mm-hmm. It was when the insurance company's negotiated rate on that bill was approximately $3,500. And then as given it was a preferred provider, I paid 10% of that. Had I not had insurance, and this was critical insurance surgery because it was regarding a tumor which turned out to be benign, but no one knew, if I had not had insurance, I would have to pay that $8,000.
Right. That's a very interesting point, Marianne. Go ahead, Karen, on this.
I actually wrote a cover story about my own brother's experiences on this very subject earlier this year. My brother had what he thought was an insurance policy. He gets sick and discovers it isn't going to cover anything. I was shocked to see the prices that people who don't have insurance pay. In some cases, my brother was paying 8 times as much for lab work as his insurance company would have paid. Procedures that his insurance company would have been charged $900, he was getting charged $4,000 for. And it's true. These are the people who can least afford these big medical bills, and they're the ones getting charged them.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. But, Karen, this raises one of the key issues in the bill. Can you provide pools? Can you find a mechanism so that people like Marianne and your brother can have some of the same purchasing power and to drive down costs by pooling their small business or individuals?
Only if everybody or nearly everybody is covered, which is why the individual mandate, the requirement that you buy insurance, is such an important part of holding this whole bill together.
I think we have time for perhaps one more caller. Lynn in Dayton, Ohio. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi. I have a question about the statement that the public plan is just a sop to single-payer advocates. How can it be a sop when the Congressional Budget Office scored the HELP committee as going from $1 trillion to $600 billion. That's a 40% decrease when you add a public option in. And how can it be a sop when Wendell Potter, the former high-level Cigna executive, now turned courageous advocate for health care reform, says we have to have a public plan option in order to do any kind of reasonable bringing down of prices?
Okay, Lynn, thank you very much. I think you were the one, Jonathan.
No, I think it was Karen.
Karen,
actually,
but I mean,
yeah,
look, the SOP, I mean,
the score went down not because of the public option. The public option was there all along. The score went down when they added an employer mandate to the bill, is when the price tag on the Senate Help Committee went down.
Why has, you could hear in that Lynn's voice, a really fierce commitment to the public option, John. Why has that become the touchstone here?
Well, I mean, I guess there are a number of different reasons. One of the things she seemed to be getting at is the idea people, liberals who support the public option, are angry at the notion that it's being described as a kind of pet rock of liberals. They mm-hmm. they keep saying, no, these poll numbers are huge in support of it. But I think the other thing is that people believe that this is the only way you can get the insurance companies to behave, honorably, or at least to put some these rapacious insurance companies, as they describe them, are making all of this crazy money in profits, and the little guy is getting squeezed, and this is the only way for the little guy to fight
back.
But
I think, I mean, there is a very strong argument for that, because what people are saying is, look, there are insurance companies, thousands of insurance companies. They are competing. Obviously, the competition isn't having a whole lot of impact on price. So we need something new. What's new? A public option would be new.
And Karen, finally, a part of the political calculation here is callers like our last one, committed liberals who thought we finally have a Democratic president. We have a Democratic Congress. But the fact that there's a Democratic majority does not mean there's a liberal majority. They're not the same thing. And this frustrated conservatives during the Bush administration is frustrating liberals now.
It's because the new members who gave them their majority come from much more conservative districts, from suburban districts. And to hold on to that majority, and hold on to those members is why they are moderating the bill.
And Nancy Pelosi, in fact, uses the phrase "my majority makers," and she understands on some level, even though she represents a very liberal constituency, that the Democrats cannot be a majority simply by electing congressmen from San Francisco.
Yeah, I looked at the 20 richest districts, and in 1995, the 20 richest districts were represented by, I think, 16 Republicans. Now they're represented by about 16 Democrats. Rich suburban districts, they tend to be socially liberal, but they pay a lot of taxes, and they're very sensitive to what's going on in Washington.
That's going to have to be the last word. Jonathan Weissman from The Wall Street Journal, thanks so much for being with us. Karen Tumulty from Time Magazine, John Dickerson from Slate. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Rehm, and I want to thank you all for spending part of your morning with us. And thanks a lot.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.